The very first video that I shot for Cool Cars with Chris was with Courage's Hyundai Elantra N series car. Now, Courage himself is also a YouTuber. He's got a YouTube channel. It's called The Driven Dad. And today we're peeling back the curtain a little bit, discussing what it's like to be a YouTuber, to have a YouTube channel, to have a car that you love that's centered around that channel, modifications you've done to that car, and warnings for you out there right now. If you're thinking about modifying your car, potential things you need to worry about when you do that. Let's go. Okay, what's happening? I am back with Courage. Courage himself, the big time YouTuber. He's got millions, if not millions, of videos. I'm sorry, video views on all his videos. I did it, Courage.
Yeah, I wish I had millions, but at least I have some thousands, which is okay. But I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me back as usual.
Courage, the YouTuber with thousands and thousands of views on his videos, man. He is a big time YouTuber, man. How long have you been in the YouTube space?
I literally just hit over a year. My first video. Well, I had a few that were kind of earlier on, but it's been right over a year since I've been doing it. I guess you can say as like consistent, like uploading. So yeah, it's crazy, but it's been a year.
Now, your channel is called, is it Driven N Dad or just Driven Dad? How do you say it?
So it is The Driven Dad, but I did want to kind of emphasize the N to kind of correlate with the N cars and the N content. And so in my logo, I usually kind of change the color of the N, but it's essentially The Driven Dad. Funny enough, real quick thing on that is that my original YouTube channel, and there's actually one video that still has it on there, but was originally called Cars N Kids or Cars and Kids. And I did a lot of, you know, kind of couple videos with the kids involved and things like that. As I realized that wasn't very sustainable, I kind of ended up changing and adjusting, going towards The Driven Dad. But there's a few videos that are still up that still have like the Cars and Kids logo. But now it's Driven Dad. So that's just kind of what I've been going with from there.
Now, was this all because of the Elantra N car you have?
It was sort of the catalyst of kind of make the move, but I owned the car, I think, a year and a half before I ever really started, like, even really posting about it. I never really posted a lot on social media on it. You know, I didn't have a YouTube channel. So I had the car for a while, and I'd gone to, like, Cars and Coffees and things like that here and there, but there was a certain point towards that, like, year and a half, 2 year mark where I started thinking, like, man, I should just make content on this. Like, part of me was like, yeah, like, you know, but everybody has a car YouTube or everybody has a car content page or whatever. But I just thought that there was something cool about how I was getting out and doing things with the kids and going to these Cars and Coffees and things like that, that I just wanted to start sharing. And that's kind of when I just jumped into it and said, just do it. Let's just go ahead and try it out.
So your Hyundai Elantra N, what year is it? When did you buy it?
So it's a 2022. I bought it in 2023. So it was used. It had 5,000 miles just over when I bought it. But yeah, that's kind of where it's at. It was the newest car that I had ever purchased up until that point. But
really?
Yeah. Yep. Every other car I've owned has been at least 10 years old, if not more. So
no way. I had no idea. What a trip.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I've owned a lot of used cars, but I think in recent days I've owned newer cars or new cars. I think my 370Z was the last used car I bought. Mm-hmm. And yeah, before that, my last three trucks I bought were all three of them were brand new when I bought them. So you bought it used in 2023, 5,000 miles. The previous owner must not have liked the car very much because only 5,000 miles turned it in. Maybe was it a lease or something?
I've sort of toyed around and asked that question myself because I don't see them for sale very often. And a lot of times, like, if they have been there, they just have about dealer miles. Like, they don't have a lot of miles on them. But I don't really know why it was sold that quickly. And it was at a dealer locally here and had its inspection and everything done. So everything checked out with it. But, yeah, maybe, I mean, the one thing that it is a theory is that a lot of people kind of get the N car specifically because it's like the top tier of the Elantras. They're like, yeah, if I'm going to get an Elantra, I want to get the best one.
Yeah, but it depends who you are, though. Because a mom has got like three kids or whatever, just needs a car. Yeah. I don't think she cares about that or would want to drive that anyways.
No, and I think this is maybe particular to like people that might like cars, but they aren't necessarily maybe looking for what like the end portion of the car does. Like the bucket seats are not necessarily, if you really do a lot of long drives and you're in the car a lot, like the bucket seats aren't really conducive to sitting in a long time. I mean, the suspension is a lot harsher than getting the inline version that's actually more of like the commuter car type, you know, kind of luxury car feel. And there's other thing, like the exhaust is loud no matter what mode you're in. Even in eco mode, when you start it up in the morning, it's loud. Like I think some people end up buying that car thinking that it's, you know, yeah, I'm getting a sporty car, but it's still going to do everything I want to do on a daily basis. And there's other options if you're looking for that. You definitely compromise a bit more towards that performancey side if you go with an in car. And I think some people kind of have that reality check at some point, to be totally honest.
Yeah, or it could be a financing thing too. That's the other thing too.
100%.
You know, they could have got the car repoed or something taken back, or I don't know. I mean, I've heard stories like that where you think you have financing and then you go there, you get the car, then like a month later, they don't get you financing and they get to turn the car back or whatever. I'll have to do an episode about financing in the future, how that works with cars and things like that.
5,000 miles would have been a lot of miles to put on there.
Hey, that's two trips. That's like three trips to Vegas or whatever.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it easily can be done. Drive it to death or drive it around. So you bought the car used. So did you get a kind of discount when you bought it used like that?
No. So around when I bought it, these were really going for about MSRP. Some dealers were actually doing markups on them, which there's that whole deal where there were a lot of markups on a lot of cars. But these particularly, like Hyundai dealers, were getting a bit greedy. And, you know, they knew that this was a kind of a more special car than Hyundai had been doing before. And so they had dealer markups where some people were charging an extra $5,000 on top of MSRP and just kind of silly things like that. But essentially, you know, outside of taxes and other things, like I was able to get it for about MSRP, which at that time was about 36, I think it was 36 all in all. And then obviously you tack on everything else and it was a little bit. Yeah. But, okay. Yeah, luckily I didn't have to be in the camp of the high MSRP or the high market adjustment, you know, type situations.
Right. So you have this car now, and you, at what point after owning the car, how long did it take you before you decided to like start the YouTube channel?
Yeah. So that was about a year and a half, I'd say. You know, for a year and a half, I didn't really do anything modification-wise to the car because I just thought it was a great package out of the gate. And I wasn't really doing a lot of, like, you know, I did take it to, like, some small, like, little tracks here and there. But I wasn't doing a lot just that was conducive to making content. And so it was, you know, it was a stock car. I drove it around. I got the windows tinted. It took me about a year of owning the car before I even got the windows tinted. So I call it fishbowling it for a whole year before I actually did that. And, you know, that after that, and, you know, after I started maybe going back a little bit more to cars and coffees here and there, getting a slight positive response to the car, you know, I started kind of doing a couple of little small modifications. And yeah, like I said, about a year and a half in is when I decided, like, I want to just start putting out content about the car. Like, you know, I think that this is an underrated car that people don't really know about. And I was proud of it. I thought that it was something that people would be interested in. And that's when I kind of made the jump.
So what kind of like YouTube content do you normally watch on YouTube for like inspiration, things like that?
That's a good question. I did kind of enjoy like the vlog style of content a bit, where it's not necessarily a full on like tailored topic situation. Like it's a little bit more day in the life, you know, type situation. And if that person's, you know, life is interesting, I kind of gravitated to that a bit. But over time, I think I've started to kind of look more towards content that like had some kind of topic around it overarching, but they were still able to kind of bring in these like more, you know, I guess you can say generic or genuine moments into it. And I think right now that's what I really appreciate is we're like a, you know, car reviews are cool, but when it's just a car review, like there's not a lot to it. When I felt like there was something that individual YouTuber or that group of YouTubers kind of brought to a topic, but then brought in their own personality to it, I really started to gravitate to things like that. And that's really become a big inspiration for me now, is like people that really can bring their personality into the mix.
Yeah, and I think with a lot of this kind of stuff, you almost get like the two types of content creators. You get the type that is all about the personality, day in the life. Here's me making coffee. Here's me getting gas. Here's me at the store. Here's me doing all this stuff. And then you get the ones that are like straight, just get to the meat and potatoes. I'm going to show you how to install this thing on this car and that's it or whatever the case may be. So you're saying you kind of like a little bit, you like a little bit of both.
I like a little bit of in between. Yeah. Where there's some people I say that there's some people that I literally I'll go to their channel just to learn how to do something.
Right.
And there's other people that I'll go to the channel because I'm just curious about this adventure that they had or something, a story that they were intertwined in that they're telling about. So I would say that's like the two sides of the coin in terms of content that really gravitates with me.
And so when you do your show, it seems like a little bit of both, I think I would say, with your channel. You show your car stuff, you show stuff like that, but you also show you at the track and you driving at places and you have tons of different like camera angles and different shots and different things. And so when you do decide to do a content for an episode, do you have to like write the stuff down and figure it all out? Do you have it all mapped out in your head? Like where does it start? Like, how do you begin to even start an actual YouTube video?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting process. And I'll say I have two different approaches with YouTube. Is, you know, there's long form YouTube content that's usually just like YouTube videos in general. And obviously everybody's now kind of gravitated to more of like the shorts type content. And so I have two different approaches to my channel where I approach my short videos as in the same process, I guess, as my long form content. But I'm a little bit more, I guess you can say, strategic with my short content. Because I know that is like that's short attention span. Like people are only gonna want to gravitate to it if they feel like they're gonna get like their value in watching a 2 minute, 3 minute, close to 3 minute video. And so I'll usually use those where I do actually write those out. I have a little like running notepad on my phone where I'll just like jot down ideas and I'll actually write out somewhat of my script. I never really follow it to a T. It's just more to like outline it and say like, these are the points I want to hit. And I'll talk about more than just like the end content. I'll talk about different car brands. I've done some things on Ferrari and Lamborghini and Maserati and even Toyota and Honda. I've done a couple videos on those of just like facts that I feel like people don't know about. And so those I do write those out and I'm pretty strategic about. The long form content is like a little different where I just kind of look for either a specific event that I'm going to or now with the end content, you know, a specific mod that I'm installing or, you know, dyno in the car and things like that, where I then kind of build something around that. You know, going to the event, I'll start to film different camera angles and different things like that. But the overall idea is centered around whatever the general topic is for the video, if that makes sense.
So, for example, if you're going to take your car in to get dyno tested, do you pack all your gear for that day knowing you're going to videotape the shoot for that?
Yeah. So and just to maybe just kind of share transparently, what I usually use for that is I have two different handheld cameras that I use. One's just kind of like a GoPro style camera, even though it's not a GoPro. And I use that usually for like just stationary driving shots or like anything like that it's really good at night. So if I know I'm going to be somewhere where low light is kind of a situation, I always have that little Insta360 camera. Shout out to them if they ever become a sponsor at some point.
Nice.
For you. But I use that for really anything stationary. I also have the DJI and another sponsor. They create some great video equipment, just to say that. But the DJI camera is a lot more for specific like sweeping shots where I can kind of detail shot certain things. And I'll just carry it around because it's so small that I see something that I'm like, oh, that'd be interesting to just kind of use that as B-roll or something like that. I'll pull that camera out and I'll kind of get a couple of shots with that. And majority of the time, I don't end up using a majority of the footage. But every once in a while, I'll like be scouring through footage and I'm like, oh man, that shot actually came out really great. I can use that as like B-roll for this part of the video and things like that.
Do you use your drone too for that kind of stuff?
So the drone was newer. I didn't start using drone content and have a drone that I was using for a good probably 6 or 7 months of like starting the YouTube channel. But yeah, over the last couple of months, I had decided to just pull the trigger. Mainly, it was sparked by my trip actually out to Monterey Car Week this year in August, because I said, I think I need a drone. Like, I mean, Monterey is such a beautiful place. And I always like being able to...
What are the rules on that?
There's certain spots of certain areas of Monterey that are no fly zone, specifically in like Pebble Beach area and stuff like that. But generally speaking, like as long as you're not like over people's property, like you can film. And the small drone that I have is very, very small. A lot of times people don't even like see it or hear it, because if you're high enough, you know, you just don't even know it's there. And there's no setup to it at all. I pull it out, I get the camera, I get the phone set up, and I can just be flying, get a couple of shots in like 5 minutes, put the thing away, and nobody ever knows I'm there.
Dude, I love I love really professional drone videos. Like I was addicted for a while to on Instagram, just scrolling and saving these videos that were like these crazy drone, like epic shots of these mountainsides with waterfalls and like,
yeah,
just flying around the beach with the waves crashing right in front of the drone. The drone's like getting splashed wet as the wave crashes through it. And just like all these crazy shots. Like, dude, I want to do that, you know? But then you look at all like there's like, so first off, there's so many drones to choose from. Like, I don't even know which drone is what. And also too, like, do you have to get like certified to fly the thing now?
So it's actually a really interesting thing, and not to derail us, but me coming back to making car content is actually a really kind of full circle moment for me, because when I was in college, I got into drones, and that was how I initially kind of got into like photography and videography. And I would go to Cars and Coffees, and I ended up getting a drone. I had like a big like Phantom 3 that I was using at the time, and I would take it, and I literally on my own, like I branched out and kind of started my own like videography company, doing more like real estate photography. But my passion was like going to car shows and like getting shots of like the cars and different angles, and just putting together these like videos where it was usually like not, I wasn't involved in it. It was completely faceless. But I was just getting these like interesting shots of cars with drones, and I just enjoyed doing it, just finding the right soundtrack to put with it and filming it and putting it all together and editing it. And I, you know, I stopped doing that, and I hadn't picked up a drone for about 10 years, give or take. But when I was doing that, I did actually have a certification. I had the Part 107 FAA certification to fly drones. And I was actually one of the first actually kind of in this area, because I was really doing this to actually kind of create a business out of it back in the day. I was one of the first in kind of the San Diego area to get the certification, and I was using that to kind of build everything off of. And the regulations, it got so crazy that I just kind of decided to put it down. But now we're in a spot where if your drone is under a certain weight class, you don't actually need a certification to fly.
Nice.
You have to be cognizant of different airspace and different things like that.
Right.
But yeah, in terms of a certification, if your drone weighs less than 240 or 250 grams, essentially, you don't have to have a certification to film with it. And that's basically, you know, people felt like that was limiting, because, you know, a drone that small usually doesn't have a very good camera. But in 2025, some of the drones that are that size have some amazing 4K cameras. And that's all I need for the content that I do, is just something that can get some quick, you know, either spiral shots or like, I like to use the drone almost like a camera and do a lot of low shots and things like that.
Yeah, that looks great. That, like, I've seen some shots that, I don't know if you've done them or not, where the camera kind of comes in nice and slow and goes through the car.
Yeah. I'm super glad that you appreciate that, man, because that's one of my favorite things to do, is like try to find a way to like kind of bring the setting away from like whatever's in front of you and like go through the car and then come out the other side. Yeah, that's
I try doing that with the selfie stick I have with my cameras and stuff, just kind of mimic the drone shots and things like that. But you're doing great work. I mean, I would consider yourself a professional YouTuber. You are,
appreciate it, man.
You're the YouTube man over there, and you're basically doing a lot of content for YouTube, and you design your show in like for YouTube and things like that. So when I come into this world, you know, a different approach, I think. So I think I did things a little differently than the YouTube way, I guess. And yeah. So I think with the YouTube way, things have to be constantly changing, constantly quick. You have to get straight to the point. I also heard that intros were not as important as they used to be, making like fancy. And your intro looks great, by the way. I love your intro, your whole intro you've done with the different car shots and all that stuff. But I've heard that on YouTube, intros are probably not as important. But that might be for those that are like into like the, here, I'm going to show you how I do X, Y, Z. Let's get right to it kind of a thing. Versus the day in the life vlogging style of show. But I could be wrong. I mean, everything we do here, content creation wise, is always evolving. It's always changing. You know, what's hot today is dead tomorrow.
It always is. And I think that's a really good point to bring up because I've struggled with that for a while too, is where I kind of had a certain idea of how I wanted to approach content. And yeah, like intros, for example, like some people don't have an intro at all. And some people have something that really just kind of brings people in and they actually gravitate to it. And, you know, when you first start doing anything, you're just overwhelmed because it's like, what do I do? Like certain people say you should do this. Certain people say you should do that. And over this amount of time, and what I really appreciate about the overall journey is that I've learned to be flexible in a way that makes sense to still keep sort of the idea of the channel intact, but just take little small liberties here and there to experiment and say like, okay, let me just try like maybe this approach a little bit different and do that enough where you start to, people still gravitate to their videos because it still seems familiar to them. But you're also kind of sprinkling maybe a little different sauce here and there to kind of see what people gravitate to a little more. But one thing that I think that really helped some of my like my later content that I've been doing is that I noticed that if somebody in the first like 20, 30 or 40 seconds of the video, if they don't really understand what you're going to either share with them or teach them about in the video, they tend to not, like the click-through rate goes down and the overall longevity of the video or them watching it goes down. And so I've noticed that like there's a certain limit to what I can do with like creative shots and things like that without either saying something in the video that kind of directs people to what it's going to be about, or just having something that points you directly to like, this is going to be the meat and potatoes of the video.
But that's kind of like a teaser in the front, in the beginning, like, there were some videos I used to watch when I was big into watching a lot of car videos when I had my car, and that's all I watched was like 370 videos. And a lot of guys would have this like action shot, like they almost get an accident or they do something, and then it goes into their intro, and then it goes into their like the vlog style shoot where it's like, hey, what's up, everybody? How you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And they go into their thing. But that whole like intro tease, like, did they crash? Did they not crash? What happened kind of thing?
I definitely say that's like a point where I'm trying to figure out maybe how to do that without like there is a part of me that like, you know, you get into the not, I don't want to just say clickbait because clickbait is kind of a different thing, but the just that, you know, I guess that unanticipated danger, you know, of something. And then you watch it and you find out, oh, well, that isn't really what happened. And, you know, I'm trying to find a way where you can create maybe a little bit of that level of anticipation, but still being genuine with the viewer that this is what you're getting into, so that it's not like you're looking for this high, crazy moment and all of a sudden it's, oh, that's what happened. Like, it wasn't really that interesting.
Well, a lot of people do that with news.
That's 100%.
With radio. I mean, I listen to a lot of radio, and because they got to fill the 4 hours in the morning, they will make a simple trip to the grocery store sound like an epic adventure.
Yep.
And it was like the biggest, basically the moral of the story was that something happened at the deli counter that was a little off, but it wasn't like I used to listen to these. I was so like, you can't wait what happens next. Stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to tell you the most craziest thing that ever happened to anybody at the grocery store. When we come back, and you come back and you listen to it. And it was like somebody like mixed up like something in the checkout or something, you know, whatever. And you're like, that was it. But the way they do it, they got to fill the time. They got to, you know, they're there in the morning. They got to fill something. So they got to, I guess it's exaggerating, I guess, a little bit, you know, I mean, a lot of it, I guess, exaggerating your story, but that's kind of the whole experience of it. And so when you're doing something like YouTube or even a podcast or anything really, is that you're taking the listener or viewer on this journey.
Yeah.
And you want to like have them, it's like a movie too. Like, that's why movies are 2 hours long. Otherwise movies would be 5 minutes long, you know?
Yeah.
Or they'd be shorts. Yeah. That's probably why shorts are so popular. Everybody loves shorts so much because they just basically cut out all extra crap. Just give me the stuff I need in the 1 minute or whatever it is, and I'm on my way to the next thing. There's no journey that you take the audience on. And I think,
yeah, but that's one thing why I tell myself in my head that I'm fighting for the long form content, because it really is like, you have to be willing to fail in the sense where, you know, a lot of my earlier videos, and I've actually kind of had to scrub my channel because there were like some videos that just like I thought were just the best thing ever and like my best ideas and got like 20 views or something and stuck there for a month.
Yeah, but does it do anything for your channel? I mean, if it's there, it's there. It doesn't like hurt your channel. It's still there, does it?
There is sort of I don't want to say an issue, but you know, I'm careful about it because now like you realize that there's certain things that like a video can come back full circle and, you know, it could sit at, you know, 20 views for a year. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, it just decides to blow up and becomes this real thing. But, you know, one of my reasons for doing that though, is because I kind of realized the shortcoming of the video was that, again, back to that original point, was that I knew that it didn't have something that was really kind of sort of adding value in some way, whether it was teaching somebody something or you know, just kind of showing them an experience or something that was going to stick with them. I started to realize, like, I just hadn't, at that point, I hadn't really developed that idea yet. And so I, you know, there's certain ones where I'm just like, okay, that really just wasn't as good of an idea as I thought it was. There's others that I've like, I've kind of left it and said like, okay, I don't care that this has only gotten X amount of views. Like I still think that, honestly, to be totally honest, like my video that I actually bought the drone for to go out and do the Monterey trip video, which was one of my all-time just best trips, favorite trips that I've ever been on. That video is right now, out of all the videos that I still have in terms of long-term, long-form videos, is the lowest performing one on my channel. But I told myself I'm still keeping it there because I was so proud of making it. I had so much fun there, and the experience itself was something that I will always remember. And I told myself, like, I'm just going to leave that there because I feel like it's one of those videos that was just a passion for me to make.
And you always can share it too. When it's on YouTube still, you can share that out to your friends and family and say, check out what I made. Look what I made.
Yeah.
Check this out. Mm-hmm. Regardless if the algorithm sends it out to all these different places. That's the thing about YouTube, is that you're basically trying to figure out what the algorithm is gonna do for you today. Yeah. And it's not like that in podcasting at all. In podcasting, there is no algorithm.
When you told me that, by the way, and I, you know, definitely feel free to expand on that more, but that when you told me that, it was actually like a crazy, like, you hit me like a ton of bricks thing. Like, wow, it's like, that's a totally different way of approaching, you know, YouTube versus podcasting.
Oh, 100%. And I think that when you'll see some independent creators, smaller creators, do a podcast and they'll throw a YouTube version on YouTube. Maybe they'll have like in front camera or whatever they'll do. And they might notice more views on YouTube because of the algorithm. The algorithm will send it out to more people. In podcasting, the only way someone's going to click on an episode in a podcast is if somebody like gave it to somebody else and say, click on this.
Yeah.
Like, press play on this, please. And so, because think of all the steps involved to, like, first off, let's take YouTube, for example. You're on YouTube, you're on a page, and you're watching the Driven Dad episode, looks great. And then, but to the column below or column to the right side, depending if you're on a computer or the phone or whatever you're using, you'll see other car videos pop up. And based on those thumbnails, they look great. Oh, look at this guy here. He's got a yellow Ferrari. It's on fire. What's up with that? Well, like I said, that's videos. So you click on that, right? Now, were you subscribed to that yellow Ferrari video? No, probably not. But YouTube, like the algorithm served it to you, right? And especially with short form content, it's really big with short form content because in short form content, you're flicking the phone up, whether it's TikTok, Reels, whatever it is, shorts, whatever. You don't know what's coming next, right? You have no idea what's coming next.
Yeah.
The algorithm, it's like a restaurant, it's like roulette, you know, just throw a thing, you know, it's throwing it in there. With a podcast, it doesn't work like that at all. A podcast, I have to go into my phone, search the show I want to listen to, and I have to hit subscribe to that show. And then there's one more step still. after it kind of like downloads the episode or current episode to my queue, I still have to go in there and press play.
Yeah.
All those steps require the user to do.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. That's why there's no algorithm. I mean, there, I guess it kind of is in the fact that, like, I can tell you about a show, go check it out, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But you yourself would still have to do all the steps to make that happen. I can't just, like, throw it in front of your face and say, watch this right now, or you're not leaving this app or whatever.
Yeah. No, I mean, that really blew my mind when you shared that with me, and I started to understand, because I listen to a lot of podcasts and things on Spotify. And, you know, obviously when you started doing this, I started listening to it on Spotify. I did listen to the YouTube version, but typically I would go to Spotify for it. And I realized after you told me that yeah, it's the same thing, that, like, you know, you don't really get alerted by Spotify when a new new episode of a podcast that you listen to often comes up. They, you know, you get this one blue dot on the side of the podcast at the top. Yeah, you do get that. But that's only if you've listened to that podcast within, like, the last handful, you know, say weeks or handful of days.
Interesting.
If you have a whole bunch of other things that you've been listening to and you really haven't been listening to podcasts for a certain period, you wouldn't even get that alert. So to that point is, like, the only reason that I tend to go back to the podcast that I listen to is because I know maybe their posting schedule and I've listened to it for a certain amount of time, or somebody shared with me, oh, this is a cool podcast to listen to. But there's no, like, generated algorithm to put new podcasts in front of me and, you know, that kind of thing. There's maybe certain discovery pages that you can do.
Yeah, Spotify's got one on a discovery page, and I think a few of them do. Apple, I think, does something like that. But usually the ones in there are the bigger shows, usually.
Yeah.
I've noticed, like a Joe Rogan-sized type of shows, things of that sort, which are getting, you know, tons of play anyways. It's all based on ratings and reviews and rankings. And in fact, this show, I believe, was ranked in Apple charts under automotive, or one of them. It was in the chart. I saw an alert on that. I was looking into that and I saw that. Well, I'll check that out. And my other shows have been too. So the way the Apple charts work, as far as I understand, is that it's all based on subscriptions, because they know how many people subscribe to the show on their own platform. So they base on how many people subscribe to a certain show in a certain amount of time. So if you get a lot of people subscribing to a show all at once, like in one day, that particular show climbs higher in the charts. And of course, they can check downloads and things like that too. Play count, it's all in their system, of course. And that's the difference between, like, YouTube versus, like, podcasting. Is, like, YouTube's great and all, but YouTube is, like, keeps you all inside the YouTube spot, I guess, YouTube world.
They want you there, and they want the one thing that when I, because I actually took sort of this little small course on YouTube of, like, kind of building content and, like, how to really kind of be strategic about it. And the one thing they wanted you to commit to memory is that YouTube's goal is to find the right content to put in front of the right person at the right time. And that's all that YouTube is really, that's all that the algorithm's goal really is.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense, the way it keeps feeding you stuff. If you're into something, if you're watching cat videos all of a sudden, and all of a sudden you got more cat videos being thrown at you, it's kind of whatever. I think, but generally speaking, I noticed that with regular social media too. I noticed that with Instagram, with Threads. You know, I've noticed with that too. If you like one or two posts of a particular type of post, that's all you start seeing is posts that's just their posts, like a lot of posts like that.
From other creators.
That's kind of the way it works. So going back to your actual car itself, the Hyundai Elantra N, what mods have you done to the car? First mod, what'd you do?
Yeah, so first mod was purely cosmetic. I got these, like, bad skin overlays for the front, the DRLs particularly. And so they have these yellow, if you've seen it, has those yellow kind of tint over the DRLs. So that was the first quote unquote mod I've done to the car. And that was the only thing I'd done for a while.
And window tint too, right?
And window tint, so that was the first. The window tint, then I guess you can say the DRL tint was the second.
And then what about, like, those wheels are stock, or did you get upgraded wheels?
No, so those wheels were one of the last mods I've done, actually.
Oh.
Those, Yeah. So I before that, they came shortly after I did some of the other things, but I did the intake, the air intake first. That was the first, like, really, I guess you can say, intrusive mod where, you know, I took something that was completely a stock, you know, sort of mechanical right. part and changed that out. And so, yeah, I installed the air intake. And then along with that, I think around the same time, I put on kind of the front lip in the front. So there's a black lip that goes around the front end below like the red strip. And I did side skirts along with it. So I had that look for a while, but I still had stock wheels. And the funny thing with the wheels was that I had really got on to that point where I really wanted to get some different wheels because the stock wheels are cool. It's a great kind of aggressive design.
What size are the stock wheels?
They're 19s, 19
that's
inches.
That's good size.
Yeah. Yeah, so size-wise, like, I had no issue with it. I thought it fit the car profile-wise, but the design was just a little too busy overall, and I just kind of had an idea of what I thought the car would, what I wanted it to look like. And I ended up really, there were two wheels that were really close competitors, and really the only reason I went with the ones I have, which shout out to Anki Wheels, another, you know, potential sponsor. But,
I got all these sponsors lined up.
All these, yeah.
I'm gonna be like a NASCAR. Like a,
yeah, you're just going to have to have all the, like, down the window
right.
all of them. But Anki Wheels, I have PX10s is what they're called. And they're a gunmetal gray PX10. They were the second choice. I was looking at another pair of bronze wheels that I really actually still to this day. I love it. And I've seen a couple cars that have them as well. But they told me that the wheel was going to be back ordered for 3 to 4 months.
Now, what is the advantage of swapping out those wheels? Were they the same size? Were they bigger, wider, what?
They were so they're a bit wider. They're a different offset. So overall, the wheel is a little wider. And so it actually sits flush with the fender now, okay. as opposed to kind of being a little bit more tucked inside the fender
Got
stock.
It.
And then just the design. Like, I think the design for me was just a little bit more of what I thought the car kind of looked better with. It was just like, I always kind of like somewhat of like the multi-spoke, but like the smaller spoked wheels. And so it was design-wise, but also, yeah, like I said, the width was a little bit different to make it flush without using spacers, which I was actually a big fan of not having to use spacers. And then on top of that, they actually are a little bit lighter than stock wheels too, which is a overall benefit.
How much lighter are we talking? Like a few pounds?
A few pounds, yeah. Like there's okay. sometimes where people will go with wheels that really do save you like a good like
Well, you're talking
10
like carbon fiber at that point, that kind of thing, but...
Yeah, or like a really well-forged wheel.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
Versus like a stock wheel, if you're saving 10 pounds like per wheel, like you're shaving off 40 pounds, you know, 40 to 50 pounds-ish, like that's actually a difference, like in terms of, you know, the whole unsprung mass and all of that.
Okay, so what was another mod you've done?
So the biggest mod and my latest, probably three videos have been pertaining around this, was the JB4 piggyback tune.
So explain to everybody listening at home, what is a piggyback tune versus a regular laptop tune? Or is it the same thing? I don't know.
No, so there's a difference, mainly that piggyback tune essentially is a separate module outside of the ECU that now does sort of the tuning characteristics of the car. So JB4 is a certain brand of tuning or piggyback tunes that basically it plugs into certain sensors within the engine bay, but it still keeps the ECU completely intact. And so basically it's intercepting the information from the ECU, and in real time it'll make edits to it based on whatever maps you're using and tune the car almost on the go. And
it does, is it fly under the radar, so it doesn't like throw on check engine lights and warnings and things like that?
No, like it has its own fail safes and safety, you know, kind of situations, but it doesn't throw a code, mainly because the ECU technically doesn't quite, it doesn't know that there's something in between it and
your input. How does that work then? How does it not know? Because I would think I have to go from before it goes to the, because the general computer for the car runs everything and it has to, does it go in front of that or after that?
So if you think about it this way, it's like, say, because one of the sensors that you tie into is your fuel rail sensor to like understand like what's going on with your fuel system, how much fuel is being inputted at a certain RPM. that's one of the sensors that you kind of, that the JP4 sits in between with the ECU. So what happens is you get that sensor from just what's going on with the engine itself. It plugs into the JP4 plugs into it, but it's also still plugged into the ECU. And so it feeds through the sensor. It then feeds to the ECU, but then it feeds to the JP4, which then articulates the value to what it needs to get you to that like optimal boost level. Really, at the end of the day, like all the JP4 is doing is allowing the car to safely pull more boost than it would under normal circumstances is the best way that I can think of to explain it. There might be some other people that have way more of a better explanation.
Okay. And as far as you know, I mean, you haven't taken the thing through a California smog emissions yet. And when you do, what happens with that?
It won't be there.
Okay. So you just you unplug it and then the car as far as they can tell, nothing's been touched.
We won't. Basically, this conversation never happened, and the car is completely stock. But it's plug and play, in which that's kind of somewhat of the benefit of the JP4 versus an actual ECU tune that we can maybe chat about. But you're never actually fully changing any specific parameters within the ECU itself. And so that's why with the JP4, once it's unplugged, you're going completely back to a full stock, situation. And for me, that was, the benefit to that was I'm not hugely worried about that portion of it yet. Obviously, I will be when I have to deal with it. But, 100%. Yeah, I agree. Like, it'll be on my mind when I have to deal with it. But the biggest thing with the JP4 that I really have benefited from is that I understand a lot more about sort of like tuning parameters now than I did before. A lot of people jump straight into getting their ECU tuned by, hopefully a reputable company that does it. But they're the ones that are in control of the parameters that they change and what parameters they're looking for to make sure that the tune is safe for the car. For me, using the JP4 over the last, I think, probably 4 months or so, I've really started to understand more about like air fuel ratios and ignition timing and like what's safe ignition timing, adjustment versus what's
not safe.
Can
you go too far with this thing? I mean, can you crank it to like
100%. And one big thing that I found out literally yesterday was that I actually have a custom Map 6 tune for the car, which means that so JP4 has maps that are pre-installed for that platform of car because they've tuned these cars and they've actually put these as preset maps within the car. But you have the ability to have a custom Map 6 that you personally could actually tune. But obviously, if you don't know what you're doing, you would want that tuned by a professional.
Fail-safes, though. I thought that JP4 has got fail-safes to help protect the ECU from blowing up.
It does. It helps other things from blowing up, too. But it has those fail-safes. But you can adjust those parameters, obviously, if you know what you're doing with it. But the guy who I had tune the car has a fail-safe of, like, for example, for boost safety. It keeps the car from going anything over 25 pounds of boost, 25 PSI, which is high. But right now, the like kind of sweet spot for the car is actually pushing 22 to 23 PSI. And that's actually like, even for people that are tuning the car, is like the car can handle it. Like the turbos, the turbo that they're using and all the other like internals, they handle that boost pressure pretty well. But the issue with the in cars particularly is when they run in their fuel optimization mode, which is called octane learning.
And that's stock with Hyundai. It's not a stock.
This isn't a tune. Yeah, this is just stock Hyundai. And not to get too nerdy, but simply put, if your peak boost when the car is an octane learn is about 15 to 16 PSI. When the car is octane learned with the stock ECU's capability, it automatically bumps that peak horsepower up to 19 to 20 PSI. And so with the custom Map 6 that I had built out for me, it basically puts the car up to 20 to 23 PSI from non-octane learn status. So if the car Octane learns itself and you still are in that custom map 6 mode, basically just add 4 PSI to that, and that's not a good thing.
So you're hitting like 25, 27 PSI somewhere around there, right?
If you didn't have a boost safety, yeah. If you didn't have a boost safety on, you'd be running closer to 25, 27 or close to 28 PSI at like peak boost.
No way, man.
Yeah. So I thought that I put in enough fuel to get the car to forget its octane learning. And I was getting on the highway and I went to go for it. And I knew like you just felt it. The car like was like kind of holding itself back. And I looked at my, like, I always keep my like dash PSI viewing on. And I saw that it was peaking at 20 PSI, but I was in that map 6. And so it was literally, you could hear the car kind of holding itself back from going anything beyond 25 PSI. And it was a scary feeling. I'm not going to lie. Like, and well, now I'm like really cognizant of that when I'm switching between maps.
If something were to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be covered in a warranty or insurance?
Absolutely not.
Oh, that'd be scary, huh?
So, you know, I mentioned this on my one of my videos when I started going down this road, is that, you know, I take full responsibility for, you know, tuning a car, because, you know, modding a car in any way is you're introducing compromises that were not part of the car when it was built OE spec. And so you're running a risk, no matter how like calculated you are. Like, there's always a risk to tuning or doing any kind of modifications to your car. And there's always cons. Like, there's pros to it, but there's always a con no matter what.
Right.
And so I was pretty honest when I first started really getting into modding the car and creating content around it, that I try to be as calculated as possible around it, but things happen and I have to be the one to take full responsibility if something happens. And you know, again, with this situation, this is another thing that kind of keeps me just a little bit more on my toes, where you need to pay attention to certain things like that. Is the car octane learn? What maps are you in? You know, maybe the best thing from now on is to always put the JB4 in a map 1 setting from start, make sure the car is in the right state, and then you can, you know, adjust maps. But to your point, if anything happens with the car, essentially, we're figuring out what to do. Which,
oh, wow,
you know, I'm not usually taking the car to the track all the time. It's not always in its highest boost setting. You know, I'm usually pretty calculated with that kind of stuff. But you know, it's just kind of the nature of the beast. I try to be honest with that part of it.
How much horsepower have you peaked at with this whole tune thing?
So, great timing on that question, because I just got the car dyno last week, and the with the custom 6 tune, the car put down 320 horsepower to the wheels.
Wow.
So stock with the car and its best like kind of fuel optimization, it's putting down pretty much exactly 270 to the wheels.
And what size motor is that? 2 liter?
2 liter turbo, yep.
2.0. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the Mitsubishi Evolution Lancer, I think it was also a 2 liter, that yeah. motor.
A lot of those cars, yeah, around that, you know, the Evos, I think the Focus RS, because that was one, the Focus RS and the STs, well, particularly the RS was one of like the most high horsepower, like 4-cylinder engines out there, like just on its own. I think it put down like 300. It was like rated at 350 horsepower from like a 4-cylinder turbo engine. But yeah, it's, you know, that means it was probably putting down maybe like 300 or 310 maybe.
What do you think the boost was on that?
I don't know. That would be a good question. I might do some research on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just before exploding. That's a boost level. Yeah. Just before it blows.
Yeah, that's just right there. Like, hopefully there's a factor of safety, but probably not. Like,
right. Well, man, your car, man, it's fast. It's fun. It's convenient. You can do stuff with it. It can be a grocery getter. It can be a track, you know, racer or whatever, or drag strip, you know. Speaking of which, how are your drag strip times going along? How are you doing with that? I mean, have you smoked anybody or what?
So, yeah, I was out there today, actually, and I had some guys come up to me afterwards. They had a built Ford, or not Ford, a Subaru BRZ, that they swapped an LS motor into it, and it fit. Yes. And I forgot what rear end they had on there, but it wasn't the stock rear end. And they, it's put, he told me they had dynoed it before today and it put down like 510 horsepower to the wheels or something. The unfortunate thing is that he told me that they blew a trans today.
Talk about an engine right here. Are we talking about a trans?
Yeah.
That's a joke I always keep hearing about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I walked right into that one, didn't I? But yeah, they blew the transmission today, and but they have a backup there. It's a whole shop. They're pretty calculated. Oh, yeah, dude.
If you have a whole shop and a crew, I mean, you could like, you know, it's like whatever, you know, it's like second nature.
But. Yeah, 100%. But yeah, I was talking to him after because weirdly enough, the car, when I go out to this 330-foot track that I go out to, drag strip out in Paris, I'm usually, my best time out there is like a 619 or something like that, which, you know, there's cars out there that are easily in like the fives.
One-eighth mile?
No, so it's shorter than an eighth. It's not exactly half of an eighth, but it's a little bit over that. And I haven't been to an eighth mile yet. I really want to go out to Barona because that's the closest one that's nearby. But the limitation with that car is the tires. The tires and just with it being a front-wheel drive car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the only way that I'm improving my times really into the fives is if I get like a pair of slicks to run up front. And that's really the only way to really kind of dial in and get like any better times what I'm getting, because putting more power down, like all you do is just spin the wheels. And so, but I'm able to keep up with some cars that you wouldn't expect that car to keep up with.
And you also have a stick shift too. So you got to be shifting versus some of the other cars might be automatics.
I had one guy that like I've raced against like multiple times being out there, and he rolled up one time and we were just talking in between sessions, and he said, dude, I didn't know this whole time that you were driving a manual 6-speed. And he was like, now I understand, like, you know what, because he noticed like there's times where I have to kind of let off and like kind of get the car, get traction back, shift gears, things like that. And he was even more impressed now with like how I was keeping up with him after knowing that it was a 6-speed. Because yeah, like the DCTs, a lot of times they would put down power way better just because the torque vectoring and different things that it's doing.
Right.
But yeah, on a drag strip, like you really do have to be dialed in. And a majority of my runs, like I'm screwing it up. Like I'm either late or, you know, maybe not shifting on time, you know, maybe getting a little too much wheel spin. But there's a few times where I've gotten some really, really great runs and really dialed in the shifts, and it's worked out pretty well.
What does it cost to do that, by the way?
$40.
How many runs you want, or how's it work?
All night, yeah. You can do $20 and just do two runs.
Or your car has to be like inspected or whatever, right? You have to wear a helmet and all that too?
No helmet. That's the biggest thing, because I know at Verona you do.
You have to wear a helmet.
That's the main reason why, and I'm really going to do this for you as a big favor, because Street Legal Dragway is local and they would actually probably sponsor this channel for sure. But they what do you call it? They are 330 foot for that reason, is because most of the time cars are getting up to about 60, 70 miles per hour. There are a couple of outliers that have been able to like get up to like 109 miles an hour in a 33 foot track, which is insane. But most of the cars that are out there are like in that, you know, 60, 70, 80 or 80 miles per hour range at the end of the run. And so they don't have to have helmets because of that length.
That's
and
the so rule if it's you're not going fast
there's,
enough.
There's other like safety things that they've done specifically to make sure that they don't have to have that requirement. But if they were an eighth mile, then they automatically, a lot of the cars that would be out there would be going at speeds at the end of the track where they would warrant needing helmets. And so that's why, even though people have like asked them, can you guys make it longer? Like, you guys got the space, just do it. Like, the reason I'm sure that they haven't done it is because now that just makes the barrier of entry just that much higher for people to go out. Like, you have to have a helmet, and you have to have like a DOT rated helmet. Like, it can't just be a regular motorcycle helmet or
bicycle helmet.
Bicycle helmet. Like, it has to be a legit helmet. And that's the one reason why I didn't go out to race at Barona when they had a big race like 3 weekends ago, was because I just didn't have time to go and get like an actual helmet. There's only motorcycle shops around here, and motorcycle helmets don't count. And so I didn't have time to get an actual race helmet shipped out. And so, you know, Street Legal had an event the same weekend. And I said, well, hey, I don't need a helmet to go. So,
well, there you go, man. There you go. Yeah, you're doing fantastic work. Question on the car real quick here. How many miles are on the car right now?
Just hit 42-ish thousand this weekend, I think.
Okay. Okay, so you're still under warranty, I guess. You're still in that range. I guess that everything's clicking along fine range.
Yeah. There's a few things that I got to get looked at, honestly, right now, too, which the main reason I'm dreading it is because, yeah, like to the point we just talked about is like having mods on the car kind of opens the door for people to ask questions when you take it to the dealership.
Oh, my gosh, and I bet. Yeah.
So there's right now, like I'm getting this weird situation where I don't know if there's something that's like kind of some debris that's stuck in like one of my like calipers, my brake calipers. But I'm getting ready to change brake pads pretty soon anyway, once the parts come. But I get this weird, like, kind of squeaking noise every, like, you know, every once in a while. It's random. It'll happen sometimes. It won't happen at other times. But it'll happen at low speeds. And then after a while, like, it goes away. And then at low speeds, it'll happen again. But then right when you press the brakes, it goes away. And so I'm pretty sure it may be just a sign that the brake pads are getting low and, like, maybe something's in there. But if it still persists once I change the brake pads, then inevitably I'm going to have to take it to the dealer. And I'm not really happy about that. And also last weekend, I found out that my horn, because I don't really use my horn very often, is really just like last resort if like I really have to warn somebody about doing something or just get somebody's attention. But I found out that my horn is actually starting to go out.
That's it can do that? That's
so. It's actually, weirdly enough, and this is like, I guess out of, for this to be a common issue is actually maybe a good thing because it's like a small thing like that. But
it could be a battery issue. Maybe your battery's going bad.
I've heard they actually have a recall on it.
Okay. It's a
known thing, yeah, that the horn just for some weird reason, I don't know what it is, but that it has issues. And so I noticed that it just sounds really faint. I knew what it sounded like when I bought the car and after using it a few times, and you can definitely tell like it's on its last leg. And so that's
one like an old 20s, like Model T.
Yeah. It's like just, you know, something like really silly sounding. And I'm like, this isn't right. And
yeah. So, I had battery issues in my truck and I had to change the battery out, but I was driving to work one day and it threw all kinds of codes on the dash, like all kinds of codes. Like I said, back sensor's not working, side sensor's not working, transmission not working right. Like every sensor you get, like, what is going on with this stupid thing? I get it to work, you know, I'm thinking it's kind of freaking me out. I finally get to work, you know, I'm thinking, like, well, let me try to turn the car off, turning back on again and see if it resets itself or something. And I did that, and then it wouldn't turn back on. Like, it wouldn't even do, like, that battery dead clicky sound. It wouldn't even do that. It was just nothing.
It just,
like,
nothing.
It was like, this is weird, whatever. And I gave it, like, waited back an hour. I turned it back on, it fired back up, okay, whatever. And then I drove it home. It was like a Friday night, I think it was, or what it was. And so I said, well, maybe I should check out and see if it's a low voltage battery. So I took it to a place and they checked it. Yeah, the battery is dead. It'd be changed out. And it fixed it right after that. It worked out great.
Yeah.
But it was throwing all these weird codes, which started scaring me. Speaking of mods in your car, and you start seeing all the codes, or the Christmas tree of codes on your dashboard pop up. And you're like, oh my gosh, what is all this stuff?
Yeah,
and that's when things get a little scary, especially if you modded a car, like you've modded a car, and you know that these things can trigger things and things can pop up, and if something goes wrong, it can be an expensive fix.
And that's maybe the one reason why I've been a little, and again, another reason why I'm actually appreciative of like something like a piggyback tune, is that it would be somewhat simple to sort of trace back to see like what maybe is sort of the root cause of it. Because as of now, like, again, like if I were to start to get a check in July, for example, now, like first thing I would do is like unplug the JB4, plug in all the original sensors to where they go, and then see if it persists, because that's usually what the issue is going to probably be, is something in relay between the two.
Do you have one of those OB2 whatever scanner things?
Yeah. So I have that. And actually the JB4 plugs into that. While the car's running. So it's plugged into that. But yeah, I have a scanner and I have one of those scanner tools so I could run the codes off of that. JB4 actually runs codes as well, which is a huge benefit. So within, they have a whole app which is where I read logs and actually see like air fuel ratios and everything. But if a code ever popped up, it would actually pop up and log it in the app. And then you could actually trace and see what that code is, not without even using like a diagnostic tool. And so, you know, that was a bit of a benefit there. But yeah, like in that case, like, you know, that would be my first step, you know. And then beyond there, like I did upgrade the fuel pump. So I would look at that. I would see what's going on there. I check, you know, maybe spark plugs to see if there's anything with like the spark plug gap. The intake would be the next thing, where I still have my stock intake box and everything. So I could kind of backtrack it from there. But obviously from there, if I was still getting something, then it's like, okay, well, I need to just kind of take it and see who can kind of figure this out. But I had a, weirdly enough, I had a similar issue on my other car, my Infiniti M35. And this is a common issue on those too, that they have these camshaft sensors. And a common thing with them is as they die out, and there's two of them on each, there's one of them on each bank, that if you start having issues with it intermediately, the car can just decide all of a sudden that it wants to just give you the full Christmas tree of lights. It's like, you know, you'll just be driving regularly, and all of a sudden, like, all your lights come on, like, the car gets a little jerky. Just weirdly enough, like, that issue never happened when I was driving, but it was always when my wife was driving. Mm. And I've had situations where she, like, the last time that it happened, she said she was, like, on, like, a slight incline, and the car just decided, like, to go into that limp mode, and it wouldn't accelerate. Man. And I was just, like, bewildered, because I would drive the car the day before on a long drive and go do things, and nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, that would happen when she was with me or without me and she was driving somewhere. And so I changed out those sensors, which is the second time I've actually changed out sensors on that car for that reason. I've owned that car for like 7 years or something now at this point. But after I changed that, it hasn't happened. No issues. And it's just crazy what like a small $100 sensor can do to like the overall like engine itself. Like if that one sensor has an issue, it throws the whole system off. And it's always nice when it's a small fix like that, but it's just really interesting when cars have such computer-based systems that like one small like sensor like that can just throw everything off.
Yeah, I can imagine, man. It's the joys of owning a car, you know, the joys of driving. And I think you have to know or have a decent mechanic in your close vicinity. I mean, to take your car to and hopefully don't gouge you.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the thing. You just never know. Sometimes I go to a shop, you know, and like guys telling me all the stuff for the car, needs all this stuff. Like, okay, yeah, I think back in my head, I'm thinking, yeah, he's screwing me right now. He's totally screwing me over right now. I could feel it. Yeah. But I'm just going to go along with, kind of know what he's talking about. I'm like, yeah, okay, I got it. Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And then you're figuring out, how do I like leave here kindly without... without offending the guy. Like.
Yeah. I'll be back. Yeah. You said the unicorn and the muffler is making noise. Yeah. It makes sense. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I mean, of course I got to get that checked out right away. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. I'll give you a call. Like.
Well, what is that? $1,000? That sounds about right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
No problem. I'll take care of it, man. Well, Courage, this has been so fantastic having you on the show tonight, stopping by, you know, bringing your cool car and, you know, talk about YouTube and talk about all your cool car stuff you've done with your car, and hopefully the car doesn't blow up on you. That's the ultimate goal, man.
That's the ultimate goal. We're going to be safe as we can. But just want to say, Chris, appreciate you as usual. And I mean, you know, Cool Cars with Chris, I know this was originally how we met, was, you know, you starting this podcast up and highlighting folks with cars and the story behind it. And, you know, I just want to say for anybody listening out there in the SoCal area, you got to hit Chris up, because there's so many, there's a story behind every car. And, you know, the opportunity to be able to share that with people, I think is something that a lot of people will appreciate. And so I just think there's a cool concept behind that. And so just wanted to say that, like, I'm just, you know, I'm appreciative that you're out there, you know, highlighting folks' stories behind their cool cars, man.
That's what it's about. It's about people and cars and coolness all around. Well, you listening at home, I appreciate you too. And if you want to follow along, of course, you can go to coolcarswithchris.com. And I will see you on the very next one.